Toll, dass ihr dabei seid bei der aktuellen Folge dieses Interview-Podcasts Advantage. Hier bekommt ihr kostenlos die erste Hälfte des Gesprächs der neuen Folge. Das Gespräch endet nach der Hälfte des Interviews und das gesamte Interview, das gibt's exklusiv auf der Patreon-Seite dieses Podcasts unter www.patreon.com/advantagepodcast. Und jetzt viel Spaß beim Hören. Advantage, Folge 32.
Yes, dear listeners, it's about time for episode 33 today in English, because you already know that I tried to speak with an international colleague about tennis one time each month, and it's a pleasure to have a connection to London right now, to Tumani Karayal. Hello, good evening.
Hello, thanks for having me, Yannick.
Finally. Thanks for taking the time for me after a long working day during the Australian Open. It's a pleasure to have you here. And as I already mentioned, we are a few days, as your tennis followers already know, before the end of the Australian Open. It's Thursday evening. It's short before 9 p.m. in Germany and 1 hour earlier in London where you are. So thank you for taking your time. We want to speak today about Serena Williams that lost 3 and 4 against Naomi Osaka today, and we want to speak about the outcome of the match, her future, her possible farewell, her present and past. But before that, we speak about you, a bit about your job. That's what I do when I have journalists here one time each month. But first of all, Tumani, I want to know about your German skills. How are they?
Nicht so gut. I learned German from age 11 till like 16. It was my main subject, my main language in school, and then after 16 didn't study it again, so it's not going well, but hopefully in the future it will be better.
I think overall, except Great Britain, the first international language you learn in school is English. So are we Germans learning in class 5. How is it in Great Britain? Do you have a choice in 5th or 6th grade between Germany and Spanish or some other language?
Yes. So it's I think the main ones in my school were German, French and Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I just did German and French, and German was the main one. And French was kind of a bit behind, but I studied them both. And then strangely, when I left school, I learned Spanish. So now I speak Spanish, but I don't speak the two languages that I spent the most of my years learning. But I mean, in England, as I'm sure you know, just the language skills in general are quite, in my opinion, sad that people don't, because so many people speak English. You know, there's not as much of an impetus to learn another language, which I think is sad. I've gotten so much from learning Spanish, and so I do actually genuinely want to rediscover my German.
Mm. So you mean it's not like that British people have the pressure to learn because it's the international language, English?
Yeah. I think, to be honest, we're quite lazy, and we just don't. You know, like a lot of people I meet want to learn another language for job or for practical reasons that would help them. But because, you know, one of the most common languages is English, there's just not really that urge to do it in England.
Yeah, understandable. For those of you who don't know, the few of you who don't know Tumani Karayal, we are more or less the same age. We are kind of young reporters out there, but you are very experienced, though more experienced than me in the international tennis circuit. You are now for more than a year and an editor at the well-known Guardian paper, one of the biggest newspapers in England and Great Britain. And before that, you worked as a freelancer and you worked your way up in the international tennis circuit. So do I at the moment. As you all know, I am freelancing, and this podcast is part of my freelancing. And when you noticed and when you said that you learned Spanish, I read in preparation that you studied history and Spanish. Is this correct?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. And then you edited another study in journalism on a Spanish school. Was it in English or was it in Spanish then?
It was in Spanish. It was quite brutal. I was when I was in Spain. Yeah, I because in as you saw, I studied history in Spanish. So when I went to university in Spain, I lived in Spain for a year. I just wanted to study some kind of journalism, so I, you know, had some kind of foundation. And yeah, studying journalism in Spanish is brutal. I wouldn't recommend it when my Spanish skills weren't great. So I had to do things like radio shows in fully in Spanish, where they judge you on how, you know, how they judge even the Spanish speakers on how fluid they are and how, you know, if they don't say or fill a word. So it was tough, but it was in the end, that's why I was able to kind of speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Did you already know that you want to become a sports writer or a journalist when you were studying history and Spanish?
Yeah, at that time, yeah, but because I had already started. I'd started writing before university. So, I guess I'd say now, my start was, I used to play tennis, and, you know, through my youth, I played tennis, and then I hurt my back and I couldn't really play anymore. So I wanted to, I still love the sport. So I made a blog, and I started kind of, I used that blog. I decided to just travel to some tournaments, and I started doing this during my gap year. So once I'd finished kind of, we call it college or sixth form, at the age of 18. So from 18 to kind of 19, 20, I was just kind of, you know, working at home, but also traveling to tennis tournaments in Europe, some in Germany, some in Austria. And so, yeah, that's when I kind of started to figure out what I wanted to do. But even when I went to university, I wasn't really sure if that was what I wanted to do. It took a while to know the path I wanted to go down.
Have you been decent in tennis before you hurt your back, or do you were an average hobby player? What was your level?
It's kind of hard to, I mean, decent in terms of, I was, you know, I played at an advanced level, and I thought I was delusional enough to hope that I could do something while playing tennis. But I mean, it very quickly became clear that I wasn't that good enough. But I played just a lot of kind of tournaments around in southeast England and around London, where I'm from. So I spent a lot of time, you know, when I was younger, playing tennis.
Okay, but it's fair to say you had the fire and the love for the game in first place when you were playing before you were starting your blog. Yeah. So yeah, tennis was your sport number one personally.
Yeah, yeah. My mom used to play it, so she kind of got me into it when I was very young, four or five. So since then, it's always been my main sport.
Because it's not the sport number one growing up in the capital of Great Britain, in London, right?
No, not at all, no. Yeah, but yeah, part of why I like tennis as well is because everyone I know love football and other sports, rugby, cricket. And so I liked just liking something different and having that to myself.
Mm-hmm. Have you been following pro tennis when you were younger, when you were playing by yourself, or started interest in a time after you hurt your back, for example?
From very young, I used to watch the same people, the Williams sisters and Saffins, and so from, I'd say 2000, 2001, so around that time.
Yeah, it's funny because we're nearly same age, or I don't know, I'm born 90. When are you born? Are you 90 or older, 90, younger?
92.
Okay, so you're even two years younger than me. But I also like the first tennis match I followed, the whole match with a clear mind, was 1999, the French Open final, female, between Stephanie Graf and Martina Hingis. Was, yeah, as you noticed, a very dramatical
match. Good match to start
with. Yeah, it made impression because my father worked During that time, he was a chef in a tennis club restaurant. So I basically spent the whole summers, 98 and 99, at this club, you know, but I was always outside playing tennis against the wall and stuff. And I just noticed pro tennis in 99. And so it was a very, very, very good start. Let me talk a bit through this blog, because many young people now that follow me or that are interested in tennis, they ask me, how can I do the same job as you? What is necessary to become a journalist? And I'm always very careful with advices in this special times of digitalization, because it's so difficult. And as you out there maybe don't know, I can give a bit of insight. Too Many was very nice to me in my first years. I came up to pro tennis in 2017 and 2018. And Too Many and myself, we spoke a lot. And he was freelancing while I was a fixed editor at Tennis Magazine. And now we changed kind of. Now he is a fixed editor with a monthly income as in a big newspaper, and I am a freelancing. So we turned around a bit, but we have a good knowledge about the other side of the work. And what I always tell young people is that you have to start with doing practice in journalism in a very young age. Like if you get to write at your local newspaper, even if a small one, or even in school, then you have to do it. And you started it on your own with your own online blog, or how can I imagine?
Yeah, an online blog. It was called Footfault. I still have the Twitter account. And yeah, I just made a blog one day and started writing. And I mean, initially it wasn't anything special, you know. I didn't really, you know, I liked to write, but obviously I wasn't experience. But the good thing about just having a blog is that I was able to write as much as I wanted to, and experience, and just try and figure out how I wanted to write and what I wanted it to, you know, what how I wanted it to look like, you know, that just to get experience on my own. And so yeah, that's really it.
You once told me when you were freelancing in the early years that it was quite tough and difficult to get accepted from the from the older reporters that were at the bigger newspapers. Maybe you can talk us a bit through how it was, the development from a small blog to a person that is in professional tennis at the press conference and is part of it and is respected.
Yeah, I think, you know, coming from a blog, and I didn't really have my own, initially it wasn't a job. And so I think when I first went into these press rooms, I had to show that I was there to work, you know, that I was not just a fan coming to warp at tennis players and, you know, just have fun, but I was there to gain experience, to work. And so that's kind of, you know, the main story that after a while of being in there, I think people got to know who I am. And that's when people saw my writing, I was able to kind of make connections and, you know, to meet people who saw something in me and wanted to help. And so, yeah, I guess to throw it forward a bit, you know, the first, from having a blog, the first job I got was with Eurosport. And it was just with, I was in press room in London in the World Tour Finals and speaking with someone from
Eurosport. Which year was it? Sorry that I interrupted you.
2013.
Oh, okay.
So it's 2013. This was the year just before. Well, the year just as I was starting university, actually. So I'd been doing it. So I'd started in 2010. That was the first tournament I went to was Linz in Austria, in 2010. And yeah, for a couple of years, I was just going to these tournaments. And I should add, it was not glamorous at all. It was cheap flights. It was staying in hostels. It was staying in places that were not nice at all. I remember when I was in Germany, I stayed in the worst place you can imagine. But I was just, you know, I was just young. I just wanted to, it wasn't an adventure, and I just wanted to kind of be in these places. And so, yeah, in London in 2013, after I'd done some work and made some money in different ways, but not a lot. And then this was where, you know, I met this person from Eurosport, had just a conversation with him about just my career, really. And I guess he read my work, and then a few kind of weeks, months later, I just got a message from him asking if, you know, they had some free shifts, and cool. He asked me if I wanted to work with them. So yeah, so then I started doing that, and that was during this Australian Open period. I always think of it because I started with working during the Australian Open, which is obviously, I'm sure we're both doing now, it starts in the middle of the night. So yes. This was in 2014 Australian Open, right at the beginning of university, where, you know, we also have exams in January during university. So I was going, and I went to university in Chester, which is near Liverpool, which is kind of in the north of England. So during January 2014, I was going to work in London, and then getting a train back to university, doing an exam the same day or in the morning, then coming straight back to London and just going back and forth the whole time, because I obviously just I wasn't going to say no to that opportunity. So yeah, that was kind of my first work. And then from there, you know, it kind of, I was able to get more and more.
That's also my experience. Like, if you get, there are a few people who want to push you when you are good or when you try your very best, and then you have to do it. No, doesn't matter how many time you have or what other things are, do or die. And if you do it good, then you can advance to the next level. But it's quite difficult in this young years. I don't know if you have the pleasure to talk already to younger people, or because you have so many followers also on Twitter. I come to that in a few minutes. I don't know how many private messages you get, maybe from younger British people that are interested in your job. I don't know. What do you say to these people after your journey now? You're just 28, but you achieved a lot. And I know from my experience and from many other people, they tell us now, like, whoa, what a life you have. You can cover the Grand Slams when it's not the pandemic, then we can travel to the tournaments. Now we do it like in your early days from home. They say we have a really cool job, but it's a tough job to come to this level, and even with the money it's tough. So what do you tell younger people when they ask you with this job?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'd agree with you that I'm careful kind of with what I say, because it is very difficult. And, you know, I given kind of, at least in my view, what feels like a unique path, it doesn't seem like something I'd recommend to other people, if you understand. So I think just as you kind of said, the main thing is you have to write. You have to write as much as you can. You have to read as much as you can. Not just sports, but in other, you know, different directions. You need, you know, you have to, well, not you have to, but it helps to kind of, you know, read articles and magazines with a pen, you know, try to understand why people, the way people write, why they are saying this. And yeah, I think at the same time, that's advice to become a better writer, but still, getting in the door is tough. And so, I mean, still the main, how to get a byline, it's to come up with an idea and come up with ideas and make an email, you know, and send emails and send pitches and, you know, make sure that you send that email and you know, because actually, funnily enough, one of my problems when I was younger, to be honest, is that I was quite, not timid, but I was wary of being rejected. You know, I was wary of I had all these ideas, but sending them to, I was scared that if I emailed them to an editor and they said no, then that door was closed. So funnily enough, I didn't, I actually didn't ever pitch The Guardian until quite close to when I joined them. It was a really weird and funny coincidence that I finally kind of decided to pitch them, to pitch the US desk, and then the UK desk kind of got in contact with me at a similar time. So it took a while. So I'd say, like, learning from what I did would be just to, you know, send that email and just make sure that, you know, look at what different publications do and think about where you can fit in and what unique voice you can bring in something that they don't have and they, you know, can't replicate in office.
Totally agree. And plus, that's my experience, you need experienced people, good people, editors, journalists, experienced journalists that trust you a bit, that see, yeah, like, there's a young guy, he's not doing everything right, but he tries his best and there's potential. And then if they reach your hand, you have to take it. And in this job, I think it's a do or die option. It's not like, okay, I'm 22 years old. No, for 21 cents each line, I don't write for you. So you have to do it because you have to prove it. Because if you don't prove it, there are 10 people behind you that will do it for this fucking, sorry, this word, sorry, but 21 cents, you know? That's the experience we all do. And it's also very cool that you mentioned that your first tournament was Linz, because as you maybe saw about Twitter, even if your German skills are not that good, I started the Twitch thing with a young German guy. He is 21, Alex Boroch. He also helps me a bit with this podcast, and we are in good contact. And he is not a journalist at the moment. He's studying also, but because he's so doing good work at Twitter and he is working his ass off, the PR agent from the tournaments in Linz and in Hamburg that are very engaged with young people that do a lot on social media, they asked him also to come to Linz with an accreditation to get the first experience. And of course he did it. And he also was in Hamburg as you were 1 year ago. Yeah. That is what I mean with taking opportunities and stuff like that. But you have to have the people. Yeah, that's very, very important. And that's also very important when we are talking about, I can mention it, that there are 49 people at the moment that support this podcast at Patreon. As you already know, this is one part of my freelancing job. This podcast I created nearly 10, 11 months ago. And for €5 each month, you get every week one new episode, and one time each month an international episode in English that you get for €1. So if you're an international listener, you get this episode for €1, and there are already three older episodes, timeless episodes with other journalists from other countries. So thank you for supporting my work, that this podcast can be without advertisement and that I can be and remain independent. Thank you for that. Last but not least, about your work, Tumani, I think you're very, not famous, famous is not the right word, but you're very well known for your Twitter skills, I think. And I know that you don't like it when I say it, but I have to say that you are maybe one of the most decent Twitter persons out there, because I think your tweets are, 98 out of 100, very, very accurate. And maybe you can tell the people a bit, like, what it's all about to tweet good as a sport journalist, to have in this less letters a good outcome for the readers.
to be honest, my tweeting philosophy these days is just to tweet less, to tweet, I don't know, just to make sure that what I tweet
doesn't work, no?
just to make sure that what you tweet is accurate. I try to mix, to tweet some stats, to tweet things that interest me. I sometimes fall into the trap of just, like, you know, some people just tweeting scores or tweeting what's happening. So, you know, I think it's just, you know, to find things that are interesting that not everyone is talking about. To not, you know, these days I actually do try to spend less time on it. You know, I try to, you know, to work, but I also think that, yeah, obviously it's important to, it can be a place where you build a base and a following. And as you said, kind of people will see, you know, if you do have a lot of followers, people will see you, and that can be a great kind of opportunity to connect with people. Mm. Yeah, just, I don't know. But to be honest, yeah, these days I definitely used to tweet more when I was younger, and now I'm quite, I try to be more like deliberate and try not to spend too much time. But, you know, I guess it's really person to person, because there is a great value in, you know, building a platform and being kind of reliable and being just someone who, I don't know, people see and being visible.
Mm-hmm. Is it related to your new job that you have less time for tweeting and doing this kind of job because you are so into it to be a good editor?
Yeah, I'd say it's, yeah, at the end of the day, they don't, you know, my Twitter isn't in my job description. So, yes. So for example, during this slam, when I'm writing something, I tweet a lot. You know, in the past, maybe I'd be writing something and then, you know, something would happen and then I'd stop and then I'd tweet something and then, you know, retweet a few things and then go back to working. But now I just try to, I have my priorities, which are working. But again, kind of, I agree that Twitter is, yeah, it's particularly for young people, this is where we can, you know, build our own bases and not just rely on, yeah, not just rely on kind of, yeah, it's where you can have more autonomy and make it clear what you are about and what interests you and what your skills are.
Mm. Do you remember when I told you 2-3 years ago that some colleagues in Germany laughed a bit towards me when I started to tweet in English about tennis, especially?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but it was a decision because of that. Because when I noticed that tennis is what will be one of my sports that I report most, and I went on Twitter and I saw the successful journalists and saw what they do, I try to see what works and what not works for the German market. And Twitter isn't big here in Germany. Twitter is not that big. It's the good old usual tennis bubble. There are a few Germans, but it's more international. And I know exactly when I started. I started at Wimbledon 2018. It was my second Grand Slam, first time Wimbledon. Great experience. I was overwhelmed also, as you can imagine. I don't know, by the way, what was your first slam at the slam at working?
Wimbledon 2015, I think.
Ah, okay. So was it overwhelming for you, or are you a guy like who can be calm all the time, even if it's a big experience?
I mean, you've seen me. I'm very just sometimes too laid back. I don't think it was overwhelming. I guess mainly because I just had a lot of experience at other tournaments. So it was a lot. It was quite surreal, especially being Wimbledon. And I live in South London, quite near, fairly near to Wimbledon. So, but it was somewhat, but not so overwhelmed.
Okay.
But
I think we don't know each other so well, but we know each other a bit on how we act at tournaments and in general. I think in this point I'm a bit the opposite of you, and that was a negative part in my beginning, because I was too overwhelmed and I was too positive, and like it was all the energy, like, wow, I made it to Wimbledon, what an achievement, and now I want to work as hard as possible. And some people misunderstood it in a way like, oh, he think he's something better. It's his second Grand Slam, and now he's tweeting in English. What does he think he is? You know, it was kind of this. But for me, it was at this time just another opportunity to get a bigger audience and to have more experience and to get one step further. I didn't recognize it in a bad way. Just when the colleagues started to talk with me about that and laughed a bit, I was very frustrated, and it took my heart, because actually I want to be liked from the German colleagues and from the international journalists, but I slowly realized, okay, if I do it that way, maybe it's not possible. But actually, role models in terms of Twittering were people like you, because you're laughing, but I noticed that it can make a small but slightly good difference if you're tweeting well. And I got connected to you guys, I got connected to Simon, I already published 2 or 3 times in English newspapers, which got me a bit of reputation, money. So sometimes you have to do the things if you are if you have the opinion, it's okay for you. But yeah, I think, as you already mentioned, young people have another opinion with this social media stuff and the digitalization. And I think in our job, it's like every 3 years, something changes. Now with maybe, for example, Twitch or something like this, you know? So that's new now, and some people will do it, some people won't do it and like it. So it's different and it's exciting, but I like the way you're tweeting, so that's why I wanted to talk with you. And by the way, if you want to follow Tumani in social media, you can do this especially on Twitter if you do an ad and then Tum, T-U-M, and his second name Karayol. And you can also find him on Instagram with the same name. And this podcast you can find on Instagram, where I do most of my stuff for this podcast, Advantage Podcast, and on Twitter, Advantage POD, and on Facebook, Advantage Podcast in one word. So after half an hour, too many, because it was very interesting. Thank you for your insights. I'm always interested to speak with colleagues about their knowledge and their work. We want to come to Serena Williams. And first of all, I want to know, what was your first working experience with Serena Williams?
That's a good question, actually.
Do you remember? Or maybe, no. What is the first working thing with Serena Williams you remember? What comes to your mind?
That's a good question. I know. I think it was Eastbourne 2012, when I was there when she was coming back from, you know, she had the first kind of layoff when she hurt her foot and then had the pulmonary embolism when she was sick, basically. And yeah, when she was coming back, I was there to see that comeback. I think she played Zvonareva, Pironkova. It's 9 years ago. But yeah, that was the first time. And then yeah, a few others. Funnily enough, I just don't think I, because initially I covered tour events and couldn't get into slams. So the first few years, I obviously she doesn't play many tournaments outside of slams. So I don't think I saw her much. But yeah, that was the first kind of occasion, and I don't know. It was just interesting to see this person up close that, you know, I'd been watching from when I started watching tennis, and yeah.
So that was your first working experience with Serena Williams. But when I would ask you in general, do you think you have like a special knowledge about Serena Williams in comparison to other players? Do you focus, or in the past, do you focus more on her? Is it like a player to watch for you because you watched her maybe from young age, or was it a player like everyone else?
I think it's more just that's just the person, player I've followed for the longest period, just because, you know, when I was younger, I followed her when, you know, being a black person in tennis, she was the person you always looked to, she and Venus. So when I was younger, I always watched them. And so, yeah, from kind of that point, I just followed them. Now I'd say, I don't know, I think it was, you know, I have no problem saying that when I was younger, I was a fan. But as soon as kind of I became a journalist and it became professional, I had no problems kind of letting go of that and just seeing things through a different kind of perspective and not sure. Really, and not just her, I'd say, because like, as I said, I was, you know, I was a big tennis fan in general and I had all people I really liked and all of that stuff. And I guess it actually surprised me in general, just how, when I just saw them as humans and spoke to them and asked them questions and they were right there in front of me, all of kind of those thoughts kind of just went away. And, you know, I think as soon as you, this sounds weird, but as soon as you see these people as kind of solidly human and with, you know, their, all of their pros and cons and all of that stuff, I don't know, it becomes much less sentimental to me, in my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, of course, it's crucial that if you follow tennis basically your whole life and you called yourself a fan, that you can let it go for your work. For example, I was a big Tommy Haas fan. I had posters in my room when I was 10, 11, 12. All the guys with long hair, Tommy Haas, Leighton Hewitt, side to side. And I was lucky because when I came up in the pro circuit around 2016, 2017 at Spox.com, he was kind of retiring. And so I had not the problem to cover him so much in the late days. But yeah, it's definitely crucial. You mentioned you working as a black man in tennis, reporting about a black successful, maybe the most successful black athlete, female athlete of all time during several sports. And we know from the past that she had to get through a lot. There were a lot of prejudices against her. Maybe I can come up with two things: the problems at the tournament in Indian Wells with the tournament directors, the comments, and when she left the tournaments for many, many years, or the late comments now from the Romanian manager with very sexual comments and stuff like that. What, before we're talking about Serena as a young black man from London, what were your experience to work in tennis as a young journalist? Were there some kind of also prejudice against you as a black young man, or weren't there any problems?
I mean, there's the, I would, like, specifically in tennis, I'd say not really, just because, I mean, in general, I tend to keep to myself and not, I speak to the people I need to speak to. So, I mean, there's the general kind of life things. For example, going to a tennis tournament and someone thinking that I'm the cleaner when I'm wearing an accreditation, and always thinking that I'm, you know, that I couldn't possibly be kind of part of it. And
that happens regularly also today?
Yeah. There's that kind of thing. Just people not really, you know, kind of just assuming that you're not a professional person, that kind of thing. But so there are those kind of general experiences that I guess people would call microaggressions or whatever. But I mean, in terms of like specifically like within the sport, I would just, yeah, as I said, just because, not really, you know, I try to, I'm deliberate about kind of the people I speak to, and yeah, so far, no, hopefully it stays that way.
Yeah, that's worse enough. My opinion or my experience is like, I made a development, I turned 30 now, and last year, I reported about a completely different topic about sexual harassment towards women in sport. And that was exactly when I realized for the second time in my life, like, I'm a white German 30-year-old young person, and I never experienced prejudice against me in any circumstances. If I was working good, some people liked it, maybe some not, but they tried to push me, and that's what I experienced for myself, that there are white people maybe who are racist, but there are also white people like me who think they are not racist, but they don't think about it because for them it's not a problem. And that is also a problem in my humble opinion, that we don't think about this kind of stuff. And then when you come up with something like that, like when you say, I go to the accreditation place and they can't imagine that I'm a proper journalist because my color of skin is black. And by the way, excuse me if I express myself not in the correct way, because it's not my best language in English, of course, as a German. But that it's very tough for me to hear, but for you it's your daily life, so that's very tough. And my thing, what I try to do, maybe it's a development for other people too, it's like to think about this kind of stuff. That's just my opinion in this kind of way.
I guess like on being a black journalist, I'd say the obstacles, there are more obstacles in terms of, I mean, this is true for many other people, but not having the connections or knowing the people or even having the kind of role models to aspire to. You know, you asked me earlier if I'd intended to be a journalist, and no, didn't really know anyone who really was. Didn't know many people who looked like me who were, even when I was kind of in the first times when I was in the press, well, for many years when I was in the press room with, you know, people from newspapers and, you know, and got to know them, and they got to kind of, I saw that people respected me. I'd never imagined that I'd write for The Guardian or something, not because I thought I wasn't good enough or anything. It just didn't seem like an avenue that was open to me. So there's that's kind of, I'd say, an issue here, and why, you know, there are very few. You know, I've been kind of really the only black journalist who kind of is there traveling and who goes to numerous tournaments, and there's I guess there's a reason for that.
I think sticking tennis aside, in general, in journalism in Germany, there's a slowly a development of a discussion, because we also have in Germany less people working in journalism with different backgrounds, because it's also it takes you a bit of money and a good family background. You have to study, you have to like all the things we told earlier in the podcast. It takes a lot of background. If you have there are not many people in journalism with less degrees or from working families, and even less black people, less people from with other ethnies and stuff like this. There are a lot of German people, white people reporting about the things in their ways, and we should take more people to get the opportunity to work in journalism, because it would also be great for the topics to report about with different views from different backgrounds. But I don't see how this will change in a proper way, like that it will be balanced. You know what I mean? And I thought maybe in Great Britain would it be a bit more, because there are more people with different backgrounds, because with all the immigration, it's more, it's also in Germany much more, but I think it's a journalism problem in general, overall in the world. Would you agree?
I think it's a massive problem, and something that's, you know, in the good thing is that in recent times, with the rise of social media, people have been able to build their own platforms and to, you know, become prominent through their own kind of means and draw attention to, you know, these things, but certainly, you know, even when I go to, you know, like football games, for example, there are many more football journalists, rarely see many black footballers and black football journalists. And yeah, just diversity in journalism in general and is tough here. And there are some, you know, publications that now do kind of schemes where they, you know, offer kind of, I don't know, internships or spots or I don't know, opportunities to black people, to minorities, and you know, but as it's still not really enough. And as you said, that the different, you know, backgrounds that are represented, then more stories that are told, and you know, yes, more interesting kind of discussions come to light. And so yeah, but it's definitely a big problem here.
Yeah, definitely, I see that. Maybe it can be like that young person see you as kind of a role model, if they see that you are successful, and maybe there will be a next gen in journalism, and that way would be yeah, wonderful if the less people that come through can make a difference. It's a bit the same like Serena, you said, you for yourself, you said you had no real role model as a black journalist. It's the same for the Williams sisters. When they came up during the 90s, they were barely successful black athletes in tennis. Do you remember when you saw her play for the first time, like, or it's possible to play pro tennis as a black athlete? Were this your thoughts when you were younger, or were you completely innocent just watching the game?
I mean, I was drawn to the Williams sisters because they are black, not necessarily because it was possible, but just because to see, you know, two black athletes kind of excelling at the top of a sport that, you know, is the majority of athletes there are white. It's something that you're immediately drawn to. And since I like tennis, it was something that, you know, you rooted for, you wanted to see. You want to see people who look like you doing well. And so, yeah, I'd say that was, yeah, that's the main thing.
Mm-hmm. I already mentioned two examples of prejudice against her. I missed a lot of other things, I guess. Do you think after all this time now, she, 39 years old, maybe the greatest of all time player in tennis, is she treated better or equally as a black athlete now because she's so successful, or are there difference after all this time?
I mean, I think actually in particular since maybe, I think the big kind of moment in terms of her popularity was in 2015 when she was going for the Grand Slam, and that created such a big kind of moment where so many people were following, and obviously she didn't get it, but I think that was the moment her fame kind of catapulted to another level. And from that point on, we've seen kind of how more popular she's become in general, and how people, so, you know, more and more people, even if they don't follow tennis, which can be annoying, honestly, because some people don't know tennis. but you know, we've seen how she's become more popular. But I still think that on the other side, there are many people who, you know, still to this day are racist towards her. Or I mean, you only have to look at, you know, YouTube comments and see people calling her a man and things like that. And yeah, I don't think it's still to this day, although there's more kind of positive and it can be quite loud, I don't think it's difficult to see how people still speak about her and things like that, which is obviously frustrating and annoying. And even kind of, I'm sure, like some of the people who now support her, I do wonder kind of in the past, you know, how they spoke about her. I think it's just a really interesting kind of mixture of her being a black female athlete who is muscular and kind of and strong and also built big, and you see all the different kind of the ways that all intersects, and people talk about her, and often it's not pleasant.
I think the last quote you said, the last sentence, is very interesting, because I was thinking, for example, of the US Open final 2018, when she had her emotional problems during the match with the referee, and we all know what happened afterwards. And I was thinking about whether this was because she was just a woman who being emotional, or it was a mix of being a woman and a black person. Maybe you can clarify your own thoughts about that, because I wrote about that and made a comment for Tennis Magazine, and I just wrote it from the perspective of that she is being a female and is treated differently because of her emotions.
I mean,
and I let out the color of skin at this, yeah, in this specialty point.
I mean, I think oftentimes, like with race and sex, it often kind of intersects, is often kind of part and parcel in that sense. I mean, that whole, the 2018 is complex, and for me, kind of with that situation, I more look at kind of how people in general react to her, and how people may see her, you know, in general, when she gets upset, compared to when they see I don't know, a footballer on the football pitch, or, you know, arguing with the ref, or shouting at someone. And yeah, so I think it's a mixture of both. Black people are often seen as kind of more aggressive, you know, as people to be scared of. I mean, part of my experience is also kind of people being, you know, I mean, you know me, I'm tall, I'm big, people naturally are scared of me. Sometimes, even though I'm quite, you know, I'm quite relaxed and soft-spoken, so there's that goes into it. And so with Serena, and as I said, kind of with her body type and how she's strong, that kind of plays into it, and how people see, you know, view her when she says things. You know, for me, when a lot of times when she has those kinds of outbursts, they're more childish, and, you know, the bad, and mostly childish and kind of laughable in a critical way. But yeah, so I think it all kind of, a lot of the times race and sex are, they go hand in hand, and yeah.
Okay. First of all, thank you for your impressions and your opinions on that topic, because it's not an easy topic, and I highly appreciate that you speak freely about it, and I think the listeners will agree on that. So thank you for that. In the last the last percentage of this episode, we will focus on the actuality, on Serena Williams and what happened today, and what does this mean for female pro tennis. I imagine you were up early today, or watched at least a bit of the match. Have you been surprised from the outcome, or did you expect it exactly the way it went?
I mean, I don't think it's surprising that Osaka won, that, you know, she didn't play her best tennis. She didn't serve well at all, really, aside from in small periods in the second set. But she's obviously been she's the best player in the world on hard courts, clearly. And she's seemed, since the US Open as well, she seems to have just stepped up a level to one where you can see her, you can see a future where she wins many, many slams, because she has a game, she has just incredible mentality. And so, yeah, seeing her beat Serena, no, I wasn't surprised. And, you know, it's just, I think it's for Serena. Yeah, as I said, Osaka didn't even play as well as when they played each other in the US Open final. And Serena just doesn't really, in these big matches, you know, in this tournament, she came into the tournament, I think, playing in some of the best shape she's been in since she came back from pregnancy. You know, she was talking, you know, everyone has been talking about how well she's moving, including kind of, you know, Simona Halep and you know, and Serena herself. And yeah, and so normally in the past, historically, when you get to a big semifinal, that's when she step up a level and play her best tennis and be there and, you know, ready to fight. And in this match, she just couldn't really get up to where she needed to be. She was, you know, after starting quite well, it became quite, you know, she lost her timing, and she started, you know, when she would kind of try to be more consistent and just put the ball in the court, Osaka would step up and just, you know, kill her in the rally. And so when she'd try and be more aggressive, she'd make errors, and that was kind of an issue for the whole match. She wasn't able to kind of play freely. And I think it's tough for Serena, because I do think that, you know, although it seems counterintuitive that a 39-year-old would be able to stay with a great 23-year-old, I think that the game is there. I don't think that the problem is her game, it's just that she's kind of lost, you know, she's lost that kind of that fortitude, I guess, in the big moments, in the big matches. And I think that, I mean, sorry, I'm rambling here, but I think that just comes down to kind of age and just how she now, you know, that she knows what these moments mean, and she knows that this won't be forever. And, you know, she's 39. And so anytime she doesn't perform, that's a waste, you know, it's an even bigger wasted opportunity, I guess, than in the past when she had time. And so I think we see all of those things, you know, people, you know, from obviously dating back to 2018, with the four-slam final she lost in a row, people kind of tend to say, you know, that it's the new generation is coming and nobody is scared of her, which is part of it. But I also don't think that anyone who reaches four-slam finals, if you're losing all of those matches in straight sets, then the opposition can only account for part of it.
Okay. So you talked a lot about the age and the physical ability, but also give a lot of credit to the parts of mentality and gratitude and what it needs in this special moments, or what was the specialty from Serena Williams in the past years. So yeah. when I tell you now, like, given the circumstances and the age difference, and it's a bit the same like what happened yesterday when Tsitsipas beat Rafa Nadal, early 20 age person beat a 34-year-old person in our sport. But given the circumstances that Rafael Nadal and Serena Williams were seen or are seen as this kind of physical athletes that were so strong that they can overpower the opposite no matter how old they are and always have the chance to win slams, I think we are the only sport who can't see this a bit because of how good they performed in the last 15 years. And I think this is kind of a problem. Do you agree with that? Or is it too easy to see like she's 39-year-old and he's 34-year-old, and at some time they have to give away a bit from this physical standard?
Das war der erste frei zugängliche Teil der neuen Folge. Die zweite Hälfte hört ihr exklusiv auf der Patreon-Seite www.patreon.com/advantagepodcast. Dort könnt ihr mit einem kleinen monatlichen Beitrag dafür sorgen, dass es diese langen, unabhängigen Interviews ohne Werbung regelmäßig gibt, und unterstützt zudem Yannicks unabhängige Arbeit als freier Journalist im Tennis-Doping- und Sportpolitik-Bereich.